Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this very special talk. And it's my great honor and pleasure to introduce Keiko Ito. Yeah, Keiko is Japanese-born writer and interpreter, and who lives in London right now. And she spent 5 years of her early years in New York City, and left Japan again after graduating. She was born in Kobe. You all know Kobe, right? And he studied and received her BA from Swarthmore College, majoring in history, and a master degree from Yale University. And worked as an interpreter for the United Nations in New York City, and then to the European Bank for Reconstruction and the Development and the World Bank in London afterwards. In mid-career, she decided to go back to university to fulfill her long-term, her long-held desire to research the historical context of her unusual international family. And his first book is called The Japanese Community in Pre-War Britain. Was published in 2001. That was first book based on her London School of Economics PhD dissertation. And then the first novel, that's the main topic for today, is called My Shanghai, 1942 to 1946, the book. And as a child, Ito often heard her mother talk about Shanghai, so was given the impression that Shanghai was a fun, fascinating place. It was only when she grew up and that Ito realized her mother's time in Shanghai had been during the Second World War. Life could not have been so rosy, yet to her mother, Shanghai's place and maintaining magical. And Ito wanted to find out why, and also My Shanghai 1942-1946 is the result of her request. So that's why she decided to write this book. I think it's a very useful book. It's not for the historians and also for ordinary people. I think it's good to have those unheard stories published for people to understand what happened during that period. And so her talk is mainly about the novel she wrote. This talk is co-sponsored by the Asian Studies, Chinese, Japanese, as well as History Department, and also Advancement Office of Swarthmore College. Okay, I should stop here. Let's welcome our great guest speaker.
Thank you very much, Professor Kong. And I'm wearing a very Swarthmore outfit because this was a present from Professor Kong and all the sponsors of this talk, but I'm going to take off my hat to speak because it's not very comfortable. And thank you very much, everybody, for coming. I know you all have lots of commitments and homework, lots of reading to do, but it's a great honor to be here and to have you here and to be back at my alma mater after over 40 years. It is as beautiful as ever, making me feel nostalgic for my student days. At the same time, I think of how naive and unworldly I had been then, and as a result, failing to take full advantage of the wonderful opportunities and resources Swarthmore had to offer. I was educated at a Catholic girls' school back in Japan, and when I told my parents that I wanted to go to college in the US, they thought only a proper women's Catholic college would be appropriate. This is why I ended up at Manhattanville College, which until the year before I attended had been Manhattanville College of the Sacred Heart for Women. But neither my parents nor I had realized that it had become a secular and co-ed college the year I arrived. Even so, I wanted a bit more challenge and transferred to Swarthmore in my sophomore year. I remember so clearly coming to Swarthmore for my admissions interview on a gorgeous spring day, seeing a seminar being held under the oak tree, under the shade of a big oak tree, and students scattered around, immersed in their books. And I fell in love with the place, and I thought I would never recover if I was not accepted. But fortunately, I was. So here I am. But once here as a student, I couldn't help feeling slightly out of my depth. The kids around me were so smart and outspoken and articulate, and the reading lists were long, and the classes moved along so quickly. I remember in a history class being stuck, unable to take notes, because I didn't quite know how to spell bourgeois, and I don't know if I really knew what it meant. Still, just trying to keep up and find my feet gave me the education of a lifetime, from being exposed to the socially aware, politically active, and engaged Swarthmore community. I probably would not have thought of going back to university as a mature student and pursue a PhD, let alone to write a novel, had it not been for my education here, which I think instills in one the pursuit of lifelong learning and also lifelong friends, some of whom are here today. And thank you very much for coming. The topic of my talk today is how my recently published novel, My Shanghai 1942-1946, came to be. It is the story of a young Japanese woman who had spent her teenage years in London, who then goes to Shanghai in 1942 as a young wife and mother. Shanghai at the time was in the midst of a war. Japan had been at war against China from 1937, but after the attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941, the United States and Britain also became enemies of Japan. Almost at the same time as Pearl Harbor was happening in China, Japan took over the British and the American parts of Shanghai and occupied the entire city. So when Eiko, my protagonist of the novel, arrives in Shanghai in January 1942, the city is completely under Japanese control, which means that even if there is a war going on, the Japanese are in a relatively protected environment. Eiko is in Shanghai because of her husband's work, and since her husband is a manager in a big Japanese corporation, even among the Japanese, they are part of a privileged group. They live in a nice apartment, and in the early days of the Japanese takeover, with Westerners still living around them, Eiko settles into a comfortable existence with a circle of cosmopolitan friends, filling her days with lunches and dinners, visits to race courses and nightclubs, and summer evening open-air concerts. But as the war progresses and Japan's control tightens, Eiko starts to see what occupation means for both her international friends and Japanese civilians, whose lives become harder and harder. Even in her settled domesticity with her two little boys and living close to her beloved older sister and family, life starts to get difficult. Seeing the suffering and deprivation that Japanese policies bring about, Eiko is caught between her Christian and Western values and her loyalty and love for her country. So, this is the broad outline of the novel. And, as you will have guessed, and as Professor Kong said, it is a story based on my own family's experience living in Shanghai during the war. The protagonist, Eiko, is loosely modeled after my mother. My mother was born in London in 1921, and although she left while she was still an infant, she returned again during her teenage years. Her father, my grandfather, was a banker and was stationed in many different overseas posts, and the last being back in London as general manager of the bank. Although my grandmother remained in my grandfather remained in Britain until he was repatriated in 1942, my mother returned to Japan in 1939 to marry my father, whom she had actually met in London when he was a student at Cambridge. But she was only 13 years old at the time and had no idea that she would end up marrying him. And as Professor Kong said, when I was growing up, I can recall vividly my mother and grandmother, my father's mother, who was living with us then, engaged in long gossip sessions over their after-dinner tea while we children would be playing around them. On occasion, for example, I would bite into a piece of chocolate, decide that I didn't like the filling, and try to shove the remaining half into my mother's mouth. This would immediately cause my mother and grandmother to reminisce of the wartime, when sugar was a valuable and scarce commodity, the two of them rolling their eyes over my unimaginable extravagance. From there, the conversation would broaden to other reminiscences, my mother's stories often touching upon her childhood and youth in London, and also of her life in Shanghai. Those tidbits of information were the seeds sown within me, and after a couple of decades pursuing a career as an international civil servant, I decided to go back to university, research, and write about my family background. I started with London, trying to find out what it was like for a Japanese family to be living in London in the 1920s and 30s. First of all, how many of them were there, and who were they? So my study turned out to be of the Japanese community in Britain as a whole, which was very small, about 2,000 people at most. I discovered that apart from expatriate businessmen and bankers, such as my grandfather, there were small shop owners and seamen, a number of whom married British women and took on British nationality. So it was a true immigrant community, although so small that few immigration studies in Britain include the Japanese. The London School of Economics kindly took me on as a mature student, and I conducted my research towards a PhD. Because I was in the economic history department, I was encouraged to take a social scientific approach to my analysis, finding as many samples as I could to delve into the nature of the community. Although people who were adults in the 1920s and 30s were no longer around, I was able to find a number of individuals from different backgrounds who had been children at the time. Men, women in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, including my mother, to give me firsthand accounts, which I could use as raw data. Once my Japanese in Britain study was completed, the natural next step for me, given that I am dictated to finding out about my family history, was to look into the Japanese community in Shanghai, covering the period when my parents lived there, which was from 1942 to 1946. Only this community turned out to be a completely different ballgame. For one, the number of Japanese living in Shanghai was far more than in London. By 1942, there were over 90,000 Japanese living in Shanghai, mainly in the international settlement part, the Japanese section of the international settlement, known as Hongkyu. And most of these Japanese were tradesmen. They lived in renovated Chinese homes, the front parts often turned into small shops, their standard of living much the same as that of the Chinese people. I quickly realized that my study of the Japanese community in Shanghai was going to be limited to a much narrower segment, to the society to which my parents belonged, that is, the group of Japanese who worked for the branches of big trading companies, banks, and cotton mills, and who lived in the foreign settlements. Even among this group, my focus was still narrower because I was interested in finding out about the circle of friends and acquaintances of my parents and my aunt and uncle who were living in Shanghai at the same time. In early 1942, Shanghai, where they lived, was still very cosmopolitan, and my mother and aunt had quite an international social circle. My aunt was friendly with British Quakers who were in Shanghai for relief work, and through them, they came to know Jewish refugees. Among their Japanese friends, there seemed to be a high proportion of Christians, and one in particular was a former Anglican minister who was on secondment to the Japanese Navy to work on Jewish refugee affairs. My family also had Chinese friends and acquaintances from different political leanings, some favoring the nationalists and others on the side of Wang Jingwei, known widely as the Japanese puppet. At this stage, I was still thinking in terms of an academic study and decided to focus on the Japanese involvement in the work of the Quakers in Shanghai, Japanese policy towards the Jewish refugees, who numbered about 17,000 by 1939, and also I'm interested in looking into the Japanese Christians and their role and views on the war, and the relationships between Japanese and Chinese on a personal level. During my research, I came upon a study by the academic Joshua A. Fogel entitled The Other Japanese Community in a book on wartime Shanghai edited by Wen Xingwei. And according to Fogel, quote, to speak of the Japanese community of wartime Shanghai as a monolith would be to misrepresent its internal complexity. To the extent that we know of the Japanese in Shanghai in the 1930s and 40s, we understand them to be a group closely self-protective and dependent on the home government and military for its security. The great majority of Japanese in Shanghai in those tense years were most concerned with ensuring their government's active involvement in protecting their community and its interests against the Chinese. There were, however, less well-known voices among the Japanese who called for peace and urged their compatriots and government to take Chinese interests into account, unquote. Fogel concluded by saying, no history of the period was complete without the stories of these remarkable individuals. So, aha, I thought, my line of research actually had academic grounds. I contacted Professor Fogel to see if he could point me in the right direction. The response that I received was rather discouraging, something to the effect that it was too disparate and difficult. And so it was. All the bits were perfectly connected in my mind, centered around mainly my mother and aunt. But when it came to trying to weave the various threads into an academic study, I was stumped. But I continued the research, spending weeks in the Friends House Library in London, going over the minutes and correspondence of the Quakers in Shanghai. I also sought out and interviewed people who had lived in Shanghai. I pored over old newspaper microfiche in the National Diet Library, and I looked up the repatriation boat records in the Gaimusho diplomatic archives, all with little idea of how to put everything together. Needless to say, there was little urgency in my research, which went on only in trickles over a very long period of time. It was by chance that I read the British novelist William Boyd's Any Human Heart, which is a novel of a man's life all in diary form. It then occurred to me that in a diary of a young Japanese woman in Shanghai, all my research could be brought to life, although in a very different way from an academic study. So this is how My Shanghai, 1942-1946, a novel, came about. What is unusual about the novel is the young Japanese woman's perspective of the Pacific War, and I wanted that to be reflected in the title, which turned out to be no easy task. There were a number of earlier attempts, none which really worked. How could the Japanese point of view be clearly indicated in a succinct way fit for a title? My Shanghai was suggested by a friend of mine, and it clicked straight away. With my Japanese name appearing under the title, it seemed to become obvious without any mention that it was a Japanese perspective. It was my publisher who added the word of the years 1942-1946, and here too it becomes immediately obvious that it is the war years. I certainly learned how difficult it is to come up with a title for a book. I would like to do a reading here just to give you a flavor of what the book is about, and I'm going to try to show some photographs, but I hope I can push the button, the right button at the right time. Okay, so this is Thursday, 15 January 1942, Cathay Hotel, Shanghai. Is this uncontainable sense of liberation improper? But how could I not bask in my good fortune to be in this luxurious hotel, far away from stifling Japan, a country engulfed in a sense of moral superiority ever since Pearl Harbor? Shortly, I will be dressing up and applying makeup to my heart's content in preparation for our second wedding anniversary dinner. It can't be like the sad send-off party for Hiroshi-sama's promotion and transfer to Shanghai, with little to eat and drink, even though it was supposedly a celebration, austerity now a Japanese virtue, to feed the samurai spirit that will bring victory to Japan. No, I will be gliding into the Grand Palace Hotel, just as I used to go to Claridge's in my London debutante days, and will be seated in the glittering dining room as if in a Hollywood film. Was our wedding only 2 years ago? How desperate I was to appear the perfect bride, trying to suppress my jittery nerves and discomfort, clad in a heavy silk bridal kimono, head weighed down by the wig and headdress, quite an ordeal for a Western educated bride, unaccustomed to traditional Japanese ways, moving from London to Japan to marry the heir of an Osaka merchant house. If it hadn't been for the warm acceptance of father and mother Kishimoto, treating me with such respect as the bride of their precious firstborn son, I would have been completely overwhelmed by my life change. I couldn't believe it when Father Kishimoto even canceled a business meeting to attend Benji's birthday party, a tea party for his daughter-in-law's dog. Even so, it certainly felt like a marriage into the Kishimoto clan rather than to Hiroshi-sama himself. I must surely have spent more time with Mother Kishimoto than with my husband. Here, it is just the two of us, living in this beautiful room with rose-colored curtains and crystal lights on the seventh floor of the Cathay Hotel, overlooking the Bund and the Wangpu. Spread before me is a whole new world and lots of free time, a golden opportunity to keep a diary. I want to record my impressions and remember all that happens in life ahead of me. And perhaps one day, when I'm an old woman, I will pick it up and recall my 20-year-old self. Or perhaps my grandchildren or great-grandchildren will stumble upon it sometime. Oh, the joy of scribbling in English. I still feel the anticipation of approaching Shanghai. Everyone in Japan had said how wonderful it would be to live in the Paris of the Orient, now governed by the Japanese. The excitement mounted. To live in the Paris of the Orient, now governed by the Japanese, the excitement mounted on the fourth morning at sea, noticing the water turn murky and sensing we were finally close to shore. But the muddy waters never seemed to end until suddenly the ship made a left turn and spread before us was the Bund, with its imposing Western buildings lining the waterfront magnificently. It reminded me of London, and I felt quite a pang of nostalgia. So starts Eiko's life in Shanghai. Once I decided that I would write a novel, I was immediately faced with a different kind of challenge, starting from, how does one write a novel? Fortunately, the UK is a wonderful country for adult education, and I decided to enroll myself in a creative writing course. When the course finished, I joined a writing workshop run by the same instructor and participated throughout the first draft. This was an enormous help to read out loud to a group one's writings and receive feedback. Still today, I have a list of words stuck above my desk that reads physical settings, clothes, dialogue, tension, drama, something going wrong, feelings. These are things I had never paid attention to when writing research papers, but now had to keep in mind all the time. The difficulty for me as a historian was how to impart historical information without making it read like a history textbook. I will give you an example from the diary entry of Tuesday, 12 May, 1942. It is the day when Tamiko, Eiko's older sister, takes her to visit the Uchiyama bookshop. As those of you who are currently studying Lu Xun would know, Uchiyama Kanzo, a Christian Japanese, ran the largest Japanese language store in Shanghai from 1917 to 1947, which functioned as a major conduit of political and literary information to scores of Chinese intellectuals and writers who had studied in Japan. And Uchiyama was a very close friend of Lu Xun and Guo Moruo. Here is what Eiko writes in her diary. An older couple sat at a table, hands cupped around Japanese tea mugs. As soon as the man saw Tamiko, he waved his hand, beckoning us to join. "Yeah, Tamiko-san, come, come, you must have some tea." His movements and demeanor reminded me of Humpty Dumpty, chunky with a meaty oval face and very little hair. His eyes crinkled with his broad smile, cutting an endearing figure. His equally chunky wife was busy preparing tea for us and said, "Sa, sa, osuari," telling us to sit down and make ourselves comfortable. "You've been keeping well?" Tamiko asked. He said he was busier than ever since the Japanese military made the American publishing company on Nanking Road come under his management. He tried to refuse, not wanting to take over confiscated enemy property. "But," said Uncle, "the Japanese authority thought I was being unpatriotic. Don't you want your business to expand? It would be good for you," they said to me, as if I would want to profit from this sad war. Eiko's diary entry continues. "I found the Uchiyamas delightful, but it was hard to believe that the shop was a famous Shanghai institution, given their unassuming presence." "You mustn't be deceived by appearances, Eiko," Tamiko said. She told me that Uncle came to China in 1912 as a traveling salesman for some Japanese eye medication, and because he had to travel so much, he encouraged Auntie to start a business. So she set up shop on empty wooden beer crates in the entranceway of their home, selling hymn books and Christian publications. And by the 1920s and 30s, the shop had become a literary salon for left-leaning Chinese and Japanese intellectuals. Eiko continues writing in her diary, "When Tamiko told me how Uncle's keen sense of justice made him protect Chinese intellectuals who were sought after by Chiang Kai-shek's anti-leftist purges, including those marked as instigators of anti-Japanese movements, I wished Daddy were here with us. He would get along so well with Uncle Uchiyama. The more I think of it, the more I see similarities between Daddy and Uncle Uchiyama. It's so hard to imagine such a man of principle behind the Humpty Dumpty-like figure, just as Daddy's amiable round face and pug nose belie his steely uprightness." So this is how I introduce the Uchiyama bookshop. Although there was much more I would like to write about the Uchiyamas, because he exemplified one of the main themes of the novel, even the short passages in Eiko's diaries could start to feel a bit too wordy. Much as I wanted the novel to reflect my historical research, in the end, a novel is a novel, and it has to have a story and a plot, and what is called in the profession a narrative arc. Which means that, after the setting is revealed, a series of events should happen around the protagonist, creating a rise in the story's tension, then reaching a point of greatest tension and a turning point in the narrative arc, followed by the unfolding of events and release of tension leading to the resolution, which is the end of the story. So here again, I struggled because this is where I had to be creative in a way that I never had been before. My research helped to form the story, which boils down to the progression of the war, starting from what Shanghai was like shortly before Pearl Harbor, when Japan seemed victorious, to what happened to the Japanese in Shanghai after Japan lost the war. But a novel needs a plot in addition to the story, and this is the main difference between fiction and nonfiction. A story is made up of a succession of facts. For example, the king died after a long illness, and the queen also died shortly thereafter. But if I say that following the death of the king, the queen was grief-stricken and losing the will to continue on alone, she also died shortly thereafter, then here I am creating a plot. The big question for me was how to create a plot centered around Eiko, the protagonist. Because the protagonist was inspired by my mother, I went back to the very basics and tried to figure out why I found her stories of Shanghai so fascinating. And as Professor Kong mentioned, I mean, as a child, my mother's Shanghai sounded so wonderful, so rosy, but then I realized that it was in the midst of the war. There must have been lots of hardship and deprivation, and yet to her, the experience was overwhelmingly positive. Why was that? Two answers came to mind. I mentioned that my aunt also lived in Shanghai at the time. This aunt was my mother's older sister, someone my mother looked up to and adored. Because there was an 8-year age gap, the sisters spent little time together growing up. By the time my mother moved to London with her parents at age 13, my aunt was already married and remained in Japan. So in Shanghai, for the first time, the grown sisters lived in close proximity. And with their children being the same age, for my mother, it was having beside her a beloved sister and best friend all in one. And as important was my mother's youth. She was 20 when she arrived in Shanghai, a poised but innocent young woman, and her 4 years in Shanghai, living through the war, must have been a truly formative experience. At least, imagining so is what gave me the narrative arc, the transformation or coming of age of a young woman. Because it is in diary form, many readers assume there was an actual diary, but in fact, it is really all made up. Of course, bits and pieces and some of the anecdotes are from my mother's stories. In the early days of my research, I did a recorded interview with her, which came out to a 10-page transcript. This helped with the factual framework, the approximate dates of certain events, where they lived, some of the people they knew, some amusing episodes. But the dialogue, the relationships, the emotions, these are all my creations. Funnily, once I started writing, the protagonist quickly ceased to be my mother, but a character of her own, someone who is only very loosely based on my mother. But that was not the case with some of the other personalities. Although their names are changed, I had specific models in mind when creating them. One reader, a close friend of the family, challenged me, saying he could recognize many of the people, so how could I refer to them as fictional characters? Indeed, was this really a novel? In my own defense, I would say that I have written an imaginative evocation, a version of the truth based on interviews and research, and that I am entitled to do this through the medium of fiction. But I do have to accept that I am treading a blurry line between fiction and biography, and I have taken the path of creativity over being true to real-life characters. So readers must not believe that everything they read about these people is true. I will read another diary entry of 6 February 1942, when Eiko is taken by Tamiko to meet Quaker friends. What are Quakers like, Tamiko? Teetotal, homely, and very serious, I asked, poking my elbow into her arm as the tram headed to the French concession. I noticed the neighborhood had become more residential, the avenue lined with London plane trees, still leafless, making it easy to catch glimpses of elegant Western apartment buildings and solid chimneys on tiled rooftops. She cast me a wicked glance and said, "Of course, they are here to do good works and lead a very austere life. I'm taking you to meet them so you'll learn to behave." The Lee's home was at the end of a row of neat two-story brick terraces, and we were greeted by a couple in their late 20s. So thoroughly English, tall and solid, both with chestnut brown hair and an air of comforting reassurance. I felt immediately at home and slightly ashamed of having been rude about the Quakers. Tea was laid out in the living room, a woolly tea cozy covering the pot. Our home is a Quaker gathering place. People from different nationalities come for study and discussion every week, Keith said. Maybe it's not so bad being a missionary to arrive from England to this comfy abode, I thought, as I sunk deep into the soft sofa. Our first home in the summer of 1940 was a children's orphanage, Joyce said cheerfully. The Friends had just opened a home for children, picked up by social workers, and we became the live-in mother and father. That was quite an experience, wasn't it, Keith? Indeed, Keith said with a soft laugh. Those damaged walls from the earlier battles in Shanghai, and that garage, which we called the clearing station, where children were hosed after being dropped off by the police car. Keith's blue eyes twinkled at the memory, but I was horrified by the thought of living in a rundown home filled with dirty children. I must have visibly flinched because Tamiko flashed me her knowing sideway glance and suppressed a smile. She's always been dismissive of my fastidiousness. Joyce quickly caught on to the sisterly exchange. We dress the children in clean clothes, disinfecting and saving their old clothes for when they leave. Once the sores and skin troubles were treated, they became part of the family. I noticed her flash a playful glance at Tamiko, which made me smile in spite of my queasiness. We miss the children, Keith said. Some were pretty feisty characters, but they looked after each other, and one or two always pulled the group together, making it feel like a real family. Remarkable, considering the tough lives those kids had. Some were dismissed from factories, being too weak from illness, and a good many spent time in juvenile prison. Shanghai has many wild uncles, as they're called, modern Fagans who make a living by training waifs and strays in criminal practices. I was amazed how the Lees could be so affectionate towards those children, who I would most likely try to avoid. Would I ever be able to see the humanity in those street children who cluster around me every time I step out on the street, pestering people and begging? Again, you will notice that I am trying to impart historical information on the Quakers through encounters with Eiko and Tamiko. In real life, I'm pretty certain that my mother did not get to know the Quakers, but my aunt certainly did. What I don't know is how she came to meet them, and I still kick myself today because over 40 years ago, when I was a student here, I had an opportunity to find out firsthand. Out of the blue one day when I was a student, I was invited to dinner by a Quaker couple who lived in Swarthmore, who had known my aunt. I remember so little of the occasion, not even their names. Of course, I had no idea then that I would be writing about them decades later. But still, when I think of the missed opportunity, it really makes me want to kick myself repeatedly. After the book came out, my aunt's daughter sent copies to a number of her old Shanghai contacts. And as one connection led to another, I was recently contacted by a woman who turns out to be the daughter of the Quaker couple who I call Keith and Joy Lee in the diary entry that I just read out. Now, this was quite a shock to me. How was she going to find my book, in which her family appear quite prominently, including herself as a little baby born in Shanghai? To my relief, just a few weeks ago, I received an email from her, which read, "I have read your book and found it very interesting. I am touched in the way you included my parents and myself under different names. My mother's memoir has now been published as a book entitled A Quaker Family in Wartime Shanghai, 1940-1946. I believe your book and my mother's memoir have places where they dovetail. Shanghai was the most extraordinary city at the time. I'm certainly looking forward to reading this real memoir of wartime Shanghai, which, in addition to learning about their experiences, should give me lots to think about on the distinctions between nonfiction and fiction, which I'm sure go much deeper than using different names." Which brings me to my conclusion on what I learned as a historian from writing this novel. What I acquired through research in terms of learning, I think would be the same whether I was writing history or fiction. But the point of view is very different. If I were a historian writing history, I would be analyzing what I read, trying to see if new primary evidence might shed a different light on what other historians have already uncovered or theorized. However, when it came to writing my novel, I had to constantly remind myself that people living in the period at the time knew so very little of what we know now. I had to take myself back in time, figure out what Eiko, living in Shanghai during the war, might know or not know of what was going on around her. For example, Eiko's diary entry of 6 August 1945 mentions nothing of the atomic bomb being dropped on Hiroshima, but she does muse about sensing a change in the tide of war. Now, this was included not because what she really sensed, but because readers know about the bombing and would expect some indication in the book of so momentous an event. If it were a real diary, perhaps there wouldn't even have been an entry for that day. What I learned is the difficulty of seeing history from the eyes of the actual participants. But it is only by acknowledging how it was at the time that a fair historical analysis can be made. One well-meaning gentleman's reaction to my novel was, and here I quote again, "Her description of Japan's occupation of China was very interesting and seemed more even-handed for the most part, though she does not describe the more vicious incidents like the rape of Nanking. The antagonism and resentment by Chinese against Japanese can certainly be understood, though it is good to know there were Japanese people trying to mediate. I am sure it will take many generations before Japan's relationship with China and Korea will become trusting." Now, it was quite eye-opening to me that some people could read my novel as a historical account of Japan's occupation of China and interpret it only within the context of their own historical perspective. This book is about one young woman's moral navigation through a turbulent world where her Western Christian upbringing and her loyalty and love for her country are constantly at odds with each other. But her world is predominantly within a domestic setting, the dramas of her life confined within her daily activities revolving around family and friends. So I would be most pleased if at the end of the novel, readers simply felt that they had a good read. So thank you very much. There are a few other, so this is Eiko and her son and Tamiko and her daughter who lived in close proximity. This is a real photograph of my mother and my brother and my aunt and my cousin. And this is Nanking Road. And then we go back to the beginning.